Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side.
Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome the author, Jonathan Schanzer. His new book is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. Jonathan is at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, where he's vice president for research. And this book contains a deal of research and the chronology of the conflict between Hamas and the state of Israel and the rest of the planet for at least the last 30 years since the birth of Hamas, late 80s, early 90s. We begin, however, in a date that is near at hand, May 10th, 2021, Jerusalem Day. It is a celebration at the Western Wall, dancing and graduation and joy for Israel, but it's involved certainly in maintaining the continuity that Israel has been obliged to maintain against its adversaries since the independence in the 1940s. But this is 2021, and suddenly rockets fly. Jonathan, a very good evening to you. That day, Hamas opens fire with its new round, its new arsenal of rockets. Why that day? Well, that particular day with the celebration going on in Jerusalem. Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yeah, that was an important day for Hamas, an important day in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's a day in which the Israelis celebrate what they describe as the reunification of Jerusalem. It harkens back to the day that the Israelis liberated the city during the 1967 Six-Day War. And they continue to celebrate their eternal capital, as they describe it. And they often celebrate in front of the Western Wall, the holiest site in Judaism. It's a moment of dancing and singing and celebration. But of course, this is something that is roundly jeered by Hamas. Hamas, of course, is an organization that is dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel, but also is infused with Islamist and religious ideology. And so they oppose Israel's very presence in Jerusalem. And so this is always a contentious day in the city of Jerusalem. But I think in this case, it was even more contentious amidst a number of other incidents that had put the region on tilt.
What you make very clear in your presentation is that Hamas looks for provocations, looks for moments it can cite, almost like a legal scholar to say, this is the precedent for why we're firing rockets against civilians. What was Hamas's excuse or explanation for why it opened fire that day?
Well, it was actually a culmination of things. And I would actually point to something that we saw often cited in our media in the days leading up to the beginning of the war. And that was a real estate controversy in the Eastern Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The story actually began roughly a full century ago when Jews bought land and built homes in this particular neighborhood. Then in the 1948 war, the War of Independence for Israel, the Jews lost that territory. It was overtaken by Jordan. Jordan then occupied that area from 1948 until 1967. During that time, the owners of that land were unable to inhabit it, and Arabs took it over. Now, when the Israelis won that territory again in 67, they did not evict the squatters in these homes. Well, they actually began a long legal process that stretched on from 1968, 1969, 70, all the way until 2021. There was about to be a decision handed down in the Israeli court system, and this was the center of attention. And the narrative was that Israel was about to evict Arabs from their homes. Add that to what was going on in Jerusalem Day. Add that to the fact that Ramadan was currently underway. There was a lot of tension, and Hamas sought to give the appearance to its people that it was defending Jerusalem, Islam, and the Palestinian cause.
However, we have another explanation that is much more convincing. April 29th, the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, 16 years president, no re-election, canceled the pending elections, April 29th. Why was that a threat and a blow to Hamas? Why did that give Hamas a road forward to attack Israel?
The context is incredibly important, and that is that Hamas did win an election in 2006, but the U.S. and Israel and others refused to accept the results of that election, and for good reason. This is a terrorist organization that seeks the destruction of the state of Israel and seeks war at all costs. And so Hamas has been frustrated before in terms of political participation in the Palestinian system. But back in 2021, after the Abraham Accords were signed, these are the peace deals, if you recall, between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and Sudan, the Palestinians began to realize that they were losing the Arab street. Across the Arab world, they were concerned that perhaps their cause was not seen as a priority any longer, as evidenced by these normalization agreements. And so they decided that they were going to hold elections. No one gave it a lot of thought because the Palestinians have been divided now for more than 14 years, and no one thought that it would happen. But after the Biden administration stepped in, they endorsed these elections. I think it was a huge mistake that they would have done so. But nevertheless, plans went forward to hold these elections in April. And as we got closer and closer, I think the Biden administration began to realize, maybe perhaps due to pressure from the Israelis and from some of the more pragmatic Arab states, that holding these elections would be a disaster, primarily because there are laws here in the United States, some of which were spearheaded by a guy you may have heard of named Senator Joe Biden, that would have cut off American funds to the Palestinian Authority and would have sparked a full diplomatic crisis between the Palestinian Authority and the United States. So at the last minute, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, canceled those elections, caused a great deal of frustration within his rival, the Hamas faction. And I believe that it was this frustration that ultimately prompted Hamas to launch that war. They sought to make themselves appear to be the champions of the Palestinian cause.
And that day in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Day, triggers 50 rockets. And Jonathan's now explained to us Hamas's thinking. It was cagey. It was organized. It was not provoked, but planned by Hamas. So where did these cagey actors come from? We're going to go back some 30 years to the foundation of Hamas and their remit when they began with a group called the Muslim Brotherhood. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking to Jonathan Shanzer. Gaza Conflict 2021 is the new book, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War in 2021. I'm John Batch. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The author, Jonathan Shanzer, and the new book is Gaza Conflict 2021. The war, the most recent war with Hamas, begins May 10th. However, we're going to go back 30 years to the foundation of Hamas, late 89, early 1990. It's called in Arabic, however, it stands for Islamic Resistance Movement. It was founded by a man named Ahmed Yassin, or he was a progenitor. But it, from the first, was linked to Iran. Jonathan, the Muslim Brothers, what is their link to Iran in 89-90? Because since then, the Muslim Brotherhood has become prominent in many states throughout the Mediterranean basin.
Absolutely. So the Muslim Brotherhood is a organization that was founded in the late 1920s in Egypt. It was really designed to infuse religion with politics or politics with religion. And it has grown steadily since the late 1920s, where it now spans the entire Arabic world. It is the, I would say, the foundational ideology of some of the more violent groups around the world, many of which the United States has gone to war with, such as Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Taliban, and of course, Hamas. Now, with the case of Hamas, it was very interesting. In 1987, late 1987, there was an organic uprising carried out by the Palestinians. It actually was spawned by a car accident of Palestinians returning to Gaza after a long day of work in Israel. The funerals turned into demonstrations, and the demonstrations turned into an asymmetric war that lasted for several years. The Muslim Brotherhood played a significant role in the organization of that uprising. And at a certain point, the more violent elements of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Palestinian areas decided to break away and create this organization called Hamas. And Hamas soon began to wage war against Israel in a very concerted fashion. And it soon found that it got support from elements in the Arab world and certainly from other Muslim Brotherhood countries. But Hamas emerged as the most important patron of this movement, beginning by 1989, 1990. And Iran has continued to play that role to this day, with financing, with weapons, with training, with rockets, with know-how for the building of tunnels. Any element that you see of the Hamas war apparatus almost always tracks back to their patrons in Tehran.
And you note at one point, 1993, Iran is running training camps for Hamas fighters in Sudan, I believe, in Africa. So this is an apparatus, an infrastructure that's quite sophisticated, linking the Shiite extremists in Tehran with the Sunni extremists in Gaza with no difficulty. Correct, Jonathan? They don't. There's no ideological friction.
No, none at all. And in fact, you know, one of the things that we've seen is the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic Republic of Iran, despite their sectarian differences, have a longstanding relationship. Their view is that Islamism, no matter what sect, must be the dominant force in politics and in religion in the Muslim world. And so actually, if you recall, after the revolution in Egypt during the Arab Spring, when Mohamed Morsi was the became the president of Egypt, his first meeting was with senior Iranian officials. And that was, I think, a very good sign of that longstanding relationship that we talk about here. And so the Islamic Republic has long looked for opportunities to train Hamas fighters. Sudan was an important jurisdiction. And by the way, when Sudan signed normalization agreements with Israel, it was a blow to Iran. But we've also seen that kind of training and assistance take place in jurisdictions like Syria, and perhaps even more recently in places like Turkey.
Here's a striking contrast. In 1994, the Nobel Peace Prize goes to Prime Minister Rabin and Yasser Arafat. The ostensible reason was that the Arab-Palestinian-Israeli conflict had been settled, all was well. Where is Hamas at that moment? Is it in tension with Arafat? Is it peaceful with Arafat? Is it speaking out at that moment?
It's actually, I think, probably one of the most important and forgotten dynamics of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. You have to remember that when Hamas emerges in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the PLO is actually based in Tunisia. They are in exile. They have been driven there by the Israelis after the war in Lebanon the previous decade. And so they are on the outside looking in. And Yasser Arafat realizes that if he doesn't do something drastic, he will be overtaken by Hamas. And so he engages with the West on this peace process, the Oslo process, as it's known. In retrospect, I don't believe that he actually was truly invested in peace. He saw it as a means to get back into the political game and to give him a perch once again in international politics. And when he returns triumphantly to the Gaza Strip and then begins to build the Palestinian polity known as the Palestinian Authority, Hamas is irate. They have been leapfrogged. And so it is at that point, really beginning in the 92, 93, 94 area, that we begin to see Hamas wage this brutal war. Suicide bombings and other attacks in very public areas against Israelis, destroying buses, malls, restaurants, discos. This was Hamas's decision, not just to oppose peace with Israel, but to oppose the primacy of Yasser Arafat. So they didn't only oppose his Nobel Prize. They opposed the fact that he had leapfrogged them and assumed the mantle of leadership within the Palestinian political arena and across the world. And they were determined to ruin his chances of success. And so when people talk about Hamas's goals of destroying as much of Israel as they can or killing as many Jews as possible, that's probably true. But you also have to remember that they had a second goal, and it was no less important, and that was challenging Yasser Arafat's primacy in the 1990s.
There are a number of details here, and we could follow any one of them. Israel is aware of Hamas's threat, but I want to look to Tehran. I want to step back, Jonathan, because you know Tehran's money is coming in all through the late 90s. I have $35 million. I have $99 million. Is this well known? And do the people who know this understand that the money drives Hamas, not Hamas earns the money? Do they follow the money as Hollywood recommends?
I don't believe that today there is a wide recognition of the amount of investment, the hundreds of millions of dollars that Iran invested in Hamas during those fateful years. Were it not for Iran and its financing and its training and its assistance to Hamas, I am not sure that the peace process would have collapsed as it did in the year 2000. I believe that it was Iran's goal to destroy the peace process, and they saw a willing partner in Hamas to do so. We look back now and you can see that it was the CIA that was noting this. The Israelis were noting it. Canadian intelligence was noting this. Arab intelligence was noting this, that there was hundreds of millions of dollars flowing from Tehran. Today, it is simply not acknowledged. And many people today even would make the assertion, and I had disputes with some analysts during the war itself, this most recent round in May, where they said, well, Iran did not have a direct role in this conflict. In other words, Iran didn't have advisors on the ground, or they weren't giving direction. Let me just say this. You know, there is that old adage of whether you give a man a fish or you teach a man to fish. You know, in the early years, I think Iran was giving the fish to Hamas. Today, it is clear that they have taught Hamas how to fish, so to speak. Hamas has the full capability of waging war, whether Iran is directly involved or not. And that is the result of some 30 years of investment by Iran. And that makes Hamas one of its very important proxies, not the only one, but one of its important proxies in the region.
I note that Hamas began the martyring and the rocketing of civilian populations in the early part of the 21st century. The significant events, however, are immediately at hand. And when we come back, Arafat's death, what did it mean? And the civil war in Gaza, what did it mean to launch what becomes a serial Gaza conflict these last 20 years? Jonathan Shanzer, the author of Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and the 11 Days of War. When we come back, Arafat leaves the scene. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The author, John Shanzer. The new book is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. Jonathan gives us a very large view of 30 years in which Hamas has been gaining in strength. There were obstacles that Hamas had to overcome. One of them, surprisingly, was Yasser Arafat, who launched serial operations on the West Bank. When I was first introduced to Israel, it was during the Siege of Bethlehem, an operation launched by Yasser Arafat. However, he is to die soon enough. And that, to me, to my reading of Jonathan's book, opens up a road for Hamas that might not have been possible otherwise. However, the Palestinians are going to hold an election. I believe it's 2006. They're going to hold an election. What does that mean to Hamas? Why do they at that time say they will participate, Jonathan?
Okay, so the story is that Arafat is faced with a fateful decision in 2000. You've got Bill Clinton and Ehud Barak, then Prime Minister of Israel. They call for a summit to try to bring an end to the Oslo process and to the beginning of a new era of full peace between the Palestinians and Israelis. Arafat rejects this. He launches the what's known as the Second Intifada, which is another asymmetric war. And that goes on through 2005. Arafat dies in late 2004. He was surrounded in his compound in Ramallah for several months. The Israelis were punishing him for launching this conflict. And when he passes away, we have the rise of Mahmoud Abbas, the new president, actually today, the president of the Palestinian Authority. But Mahmoud Abbas inherits chaos in the West Bank. The Second Intifada really laid waste to all of the progress that had been made in the intervening years. And at that point, it's very difficult to know who's in charge of what neighborhood, from one neighborhood to the next in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So then we have the Bush administration in 2006. You have to recall that this at the time, we're fighting the war on terror here in the United States. And George W. Bush is convinced that democracy is the answer to all problems relating to terrorism. And he encourages the Palestinians to go to the polls to settle their differences. And he is rather confident that the Fatah faction, Mahmoud Abbas, will win. The polls proved wrong. Hamas was, in fact, very popular as a result of its so-called resistance to Israel. The violence that it had been carrying out against Israel had buoyed its prospects. And so when the final tally was made, Hamas emerged victorious, leading to a political standoff that we are still dealing with today.
And in 2007, Hamas makes its move. It's called a civil war in Gaza. I remember reporting on it, and there was no transparency. What triggered it? What was the outcome?
Well, what triggered it was the fact that the Israelis and the United States did not want Hamas to rule the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that this is a terrorist organization that had a decade and a half of blood on its hands. And the idea that it would rule as the sovereign in these areas was just an anathema to American policy, to Israeli policy. And so it was widely rejected. And for a year, a stalemate ensued. And then Hamas made its move in 2007, where they launched an offensive inside the Gaza Strip. The goal was to take the territory by force, and they did. Over the course of several weeks, they killed a large number of Palestinians, pushed them off of tall buildings to their death, shot people in the legs and arms to ensure permanent disability. When the guns fell silent, we had a division between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Hamas was in full power in Gaza, and the PLO, the Fatah faction, clung to power in the West Bank. And that is the situation that we still see today, a Palestinian Authority divided between these two bitter political and military foes.
We've come back now to the moment where the serial Gaza wars are possible. Hamas now controls the Gaza Strip. We need to describe it, Jonathan, because there's too much assumption about what it is, what the territory looks like. What is the Gaza Strip? How does Hamas occupy it?
So the Gaza Strip is a tiny area along the Mediterranean coastline, just north of the Sinai Peninsula and at the bottom sort of southwest corner of Israel. And this is an area that's been at the crossroads of history for many years. European and Middle Eastern powers have long used Gaza as a way station in trade and in military activity. This is an area now that is roughly the size of Washington, D.C., and has 2 million people. So it's densely populated. It is really not well endowed in terms of economic opportunity. And so it's poor. It has a large number of Palestinian refugees. And of course, now since 2007, it's been ruled by a terrorist organization, which has only depleted its resources. Now, beginning in 2009, we began to see the series of conflicts that emerged with Israel, Hamas being in full control of this territory and really working assiduously to bring in rockets and other weaponry. We see the first conflict in 2009, then we see another one in 2012, then another one in 2014, and then again, one in 2021. So we've seen four rounds of these conflicts. They are very predictable. Hamas starts wars that it knows that it cannot finish. It is trying to fight against a regional power that is very advanced. Israel is small, but its military is one of the best in the world. And so Hamas knows that it will not win, but it subjects its population to misery. And what it does is it seeks out. It's trying to find probe for some Israeli weaknesses that perhaps can be exploited by Hezbollah, a stronger proxy to Israel's north in Lebanon, or Iran itself, which continues to wield Hamas as a proxy.
We'll come to the 2014 war because both of us attended it. You were having dinner on a rooftop in Jerusalem when the sirens went out. Was it unexpected, Jonathan?
It wasn't fully unexpected. We knew that there was a war that was happening. But when rockets begin to fly into Jerusalem itself, it's a surprise. This is, of course, the capital of Israel. But also, one has to remember that Palestinians live there as well. And so when Hamas attacks what it views as its own capital, it is somewhat surprising. But this is a red line for the Israelis. When Jerusalem comes under attack, similarly, when Tel Aviv comes under attack, this is the moment where Israel drops the gloves and begins to respond with overwhelming force against Hamas inside the Gaza Strip. Hamas knows this. And so when they begin to fire there, they know what is coming. And really, I think that sums up the conflicts that we continue to see. These are cyclical and they are very predictable. Hamas knows exactly what it's getting into when it targets cities like Jerusalem.
What are the weapons? We need to explore Hamas's tactics because they've been evolving over these years since 2007, when the civil war cleared the PA out and Hamas, the terror organization, took control of 2 million people. And knowing that it would be extremely difficult for law enforcement or military enforcement to get into the Gaza, they use rockets, of course. It starts with rockets M302 and M75, rocket mortars. Everything of significant value comes from Iran. How do they get it into Gaza? How do they smuggle a sophisticated weaponry from Iran to the Gaza Strip?
So for many, many years, Sudan was a crucial way station for these weapons. Sudan had, since their revolution in 1989, where the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, Omar al-Bashir, if you recall, this is a war criminal who was recently toppled in Sudan. He was allowing Sudan to be that way station. And so Iran would ship these weapons to Port Sudan in the south of the country. They would then be smuggled northward, and then they would be brought across the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt, and then smuggled underground by way of tunnel into Gaza. Sometimes these rockets would come fully assembled. In some cases, they would be coming in parts, and Hamas would have to build them with some Iranian assistance. Certainly, Hamas engineers had been trained often in Tehran in order to prepare for moments like these. But this was the weaponry that was used. But you have to remember, John, that it actually began with suicide bombings. Then the Israelis built the barrier that prevented the suicide bombers from coming through. Then the rockets began to fly because they needed to be able to bypass the barrier. And then when Israel developed Iron Dome, then we began to see Iron Dome being the defense system that is able to shoot down a lot of these rockets with great precision. That's when we began to see the tunnels that Hamas began to build with the idea of trying to attack that way as well.
Let's speak of the attack tunnels, because that was my experience in 2014. The rockets, yes, but the attack tunnels. And in fact, I spoke to a civilian resident outside of Sderot, who believed that she heard scratching underneath the ground because the tunnels were meant to go into civilian areas where the plan was martyr squads. Was that correct, Jonathan, that we're going to attack Israeli soft targets?
Correct. And 2014 was the first war where that was seen. It was the moment where the Israelis realized they had a real problem. And actually, it was during that war that Hamas launched a number of attempted attacks. There was actually one successful one, not done by way of the tunnels, but actually through frogmen who entered the Mediterranean Sea and found their way to Israeli territory and then attacked what was known as the Zikim base. And they were able to successfully kill a number of Israeli soldiers. But the idea was that they were going to start to carry out these commando attacks against civilian and military targets. But it has been a cat and mouse game between Hamas and Israel for many years. Israel continues to develop the defensive weapons to deter Hamas, and then Hamas develops new tactics to try to circumvent Israel's defenses.
The book is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies is the author. He's also importantly, our guide to what happens next. We've done fog of war. Now we're going to do fog of diplomacy. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Author Jonathan Shanzer's new book is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and the 11 Days of War. During a pandemic, we are now into diplomacy because it starts right away after the rockets fly on the 10th and Israel responds. Diplomats start making phone calls. And an important diplomat to follow here is the foreign minister of Egypt, Sami Shoukry. Remember now, Egypt was under the Muslim Brotherhood for a few months, is my memory. However, since then, General, now President Sisi, is sympathetic, more than sympathetic to Israel, and more than challenged by Gaza himself. So his foreign minister gets busy on the phone. To call whom? To do what, Jonathan?
So Egypt begins right away. They are trying to bring an end to this. Look, they're still somewhat ambivalent about Israel, but they are allied with Israel in very clear ways against the Muslim Brotherhood and against Iran and against other extremists that have tried to exploit the Sinai Peninsula. But Egypt's number one goal is to bring Hamas to heel. And so they begin working the phones. They begin talking to everyone that they can, whether it's the UN or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, the Europeans. They are on the phone day and night, and they are working around the clock to bring about a ceasefire that will leave Hamas curtailed, that will leave Hamas penned in the Gaza Strip. There are certainly, I think, some things that Egypt tried to work out, such as additional assistance, humanitarian assistance for the people of Gaza. But at the end of the day, they do not want to empower Hamas at all. And so they were, you could call them partners to Israel during this war, even though they were critical of Israel during the war, which played very well to their Arab audiences. But at the same time, they had a very clear goal. What was so interesting about this ceasefire, though, John, was that once it was declared with 2 days left before the war was over, we knew that we had about 48 hours before it would go into place. That was the moment that after 9 days of having Israel's back, Biden began to talk tough to Israel. And the White House began to leak stories about how Biden and then Prime Minister Netanyahu had moments of real tension. The Israelis never really saw that tension. And from my reading of what happened during those last 2 days of war, it appeared that President Biden was trying to message to the so-called squad, or what we might now call the Hamas caucus in the American Congress, that he was trying to make sure that the progressive left saw him as sufficiently tough on Israel. But that is not how it looked in the Middle East during the previous 9 days of this 11-day war.
Ceasefire. Important here, ceasefire, not peace, not in any fashion an end to this, to be continued. So lessons learned. The Abraham Accords, how does it now change the future for these serial conflicts, in your opinion, Jonathan?
Well, I would say that, you know, a fifth round of Gaza war is almost a guarantee because nothing has really changed on the ground. Iran continues to fund Hamas. Turkey continues to fund Hamas. Qatar continues to fund Hamas. And so Hamas has no reason to stop what it's doing. But I would say that maybe a mitigating factor, as you suggest, is the Abraham Accords, that the peace that Israel has achieved with the Emiratis, with the Bahrainis, with the Sudanese, with the Moroccans, and of course, don't forget the Egyptians and Jordanians that came before. There is now a sense that one gets that the Arab-Israeli conflict that you and I have been watching for decades is now shrinking. And instead, what's come up in its place is a conflict between Israel and Iran's proxies, or Turkey's proxies, if you will, or the Muslim Brotherhood's proxies. And so the very face of the conflict is changing, is shifting. How much it can be mitigated by these moderate Arab states, these pragmatic Arab states, I still don't know. But I can tell you that having watched the Arab media during the conflict itself, the tone and tenor of coverage has shifted drastically. It is far less vitriolic. Certainly, we still see it on Al Jazeera, which is owned by Qatar, but Al Arabiya and a lot of the other channels and websites that are owned or controlled by some of the more pragmatic Arab states, far less vitriolic and more geared toward finding a solution. And I found that very heartening during this recent round.
There are other bad actors to speak of. Let's start with Turkey. Is Turkey persuading Hamas to come over to Turkey's side? Turkey provides lots of refuge for Muslim brothers. Is it playing that card? And is it in competition with Iran?
I don't see competition with Iran. I see collusion with Iran. In fact, one of the things that I noted in my book was that there is apparently a new Hamas infrastructure in Lebanon designed to try to lure Israel into a two-front conflict. And this was built through collusion between Iran and Turkey. But just to be clear, Turkey is now the second largest jurisdiction for Hamas operatives in the world, second only to the Gaza Strip. And in fact, some of the key commanders, some of the key figures behind attacks as well as financing for Hamas are based in Turkey with the full knowledge of the Turkish government. And this has been championed by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey himself.
Russia. Russia is a guarantor of the Assad regime and much more. However, Russia also is aware of the fact that things could quickly get out of control. What does Russia's place in Syria mean to Hamas, mean to this apparent cooperation between Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria?
Well, Russia is in a very odd place. They are openly working with the Israelis to allow them to target precision-guided munitions that are being smuggled by Iran into Lebanon. This is incredibly important because these munitions could be very deadly in a future conflict. And one of the things that Israeli war planners are worried about is that perhaps these weapons could find their way to the Gaza Strip as well. The precision nature of these weapons mean that Israel's strategic targets, like their nuclear facility or their chemical plants or some of their top bases, could be targeted. So the Israelis are watching this very carefully and trying to broker an understanding with the Russians. And it is a constant challenge for the Israelis to get the Russians to understand and their needs and to acquiesce.
And Iran. The fog of diplomacy gets so thick now, I can't see through it. But Iran's money, that always is the driver. Does it continue, Jonathan? Do we know its plans?
It continues to this day. And one of the things that I warn is this, that we are now amidst nuclear discussions between the United States and Iran. The United States is desperate to lure the Iranians back into what's known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's the 2015 deeply flawed nuclear deal. If we, in fact, enter back into that deal and we provide the billions of dollars of sanctions relief to the Iranian regime, it is quite possible that we would be indirectly funding Hamas and directly assisting Israel in the fifth round of the Gaza conflict. This is something that we should avoid.
The book is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. Jonathan Shanzer, the author. He is the Vice President of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batten.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.